for a Monday, first day of April, as time moves on. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 24. Ask that Senator Devlin and Ron Murray please come forward. Welcome, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, if you would indulge me and have Mr. Murray start, because somehow the testimony didn't end up in my folder, and my L.A. is going back to get it.
Okay. All right. So while Senator Devlin decides what his bill's about, we'll go to Mr. Murray.
Oh, I'm
No pressure. Welcome.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Ron Murray. I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steamfitters, Local 290. And Senate Bill 24 is somewhat editorial in nature, and it deals with an issue that's very unique to the border boiler rules. The border rules, as I'm sure you're aware, protects the health and safety of all Oregonians through licensing, compliance, and code enforcement of high-pressure boilers and high-pressure piping systems. In the Building Codes Division, the Board of Boiler Rules is the only board that, if any revenue is ascertained through compliance, and in this case we're talking in the range of $60,000 to $70,000 per annum, it goes to the general fund rather than staying with the program. So I'm, of course, most familiar with the plumbing program, being a plumber, as you're well aware, but all of the programs, the fees and so forth and so on, stay within the program. So this is somewhat of an anomaly here. We believe that Senate Bill 24 allows the Building Code Division to better serve all Oregonians and ensure compliance to all the codes and standards that fall under the border boiler rules. And basically that's simply what this bill does. It just allows the funding that would be received for compliance to remain in the board rather than going to the general fund. And I should have talked really slow and gotten Senator Devlin off the hook.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of SB 24. SB 24 is a simple bill that cleans up some issues with the Board of Boilers' ability to assess civil penalties and receive the money from them. SB 24 simply amends the respective ORS provisions to allow this to happen. Basically, the Board of Boilers or the money received by the Department of Consumer and Business Services will be deposited to the Consumer and Business Services Fund rather than the General Fund. This money is then specifically directed to go to the administration enforcement of the Board of Boiler Rules. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, quite honestly, the practicalities of the impact of this is if the funds go directly in as other funds, being the civil assessments, rather than going into the general funds, it'll simply mean that less general funds will go to the DCBS. So it's actually, it's just a swap, is basically what it is. And it will, in some ways, make the Board of Boiler Rules more self-supporting, and which may make in the future the less of a need for support from the general fund.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss Anderson.
How much money does go from general fund to the boiler board?
I don't have the exact amount here.
Right.
Through the chair, Senator Moss Anderson, what we've been told, it's under $70,000 per annum.
Now, okay, I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. The amount that the general fund has to subsidize the boiler fund is $75,000 per annum?
No.
Because that's what she said, how much goes into the boiler fund. So, okay, let me just make this simpler. All right, right now, the money is going into the general fund. And according to the comments here, it seems to indicate that then the boiler program needs money from the general fund because it isn't getting the money from these fines, and so the money goes in there. I got nods against that going in, so I'm just trying to explain what.
Yeah.
You said it would help. You said it was a swap that would basically help the general fund by keeping the money within the program.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think, and if you look at the fiscal analysis and proposed legislation, the next to last paragraph, I think it's a pretty clear explanation there that basically what you're doing, in effect, is providing You will have a reduction in these funds that are general funds because they'll no longer be going into the general funds, but they'll become other funds, and they will still go to support the board.
That's the question I want to
okay.
answer.
Okay. All right, got that out. Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's just actually changing the name.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions for these folks at the moment? Senator Decker.
Maybe for Senator Devlin or Ron, for you, one of the concerns I've had is that does this create an incentive for the board to go out and levy civil penalties against folks out there? And I think sometimes with other, where you link the civil penalty to the job of the agency, and I can think of a couple that come to mind really quickly, it creates a somewhat of an incentive to go out and get someone because your budget gets bigger. Mm-hmm. So that would be...
I can address that through the chair, Senator Deckard. I certainly understand what you're saying, and it might appear to be so far correct on the surface, but I can assure you it's not. One of the largest problems we've had with the boiler rules is compliance. The way the statute is established, either the compliance officer must be an employee of the state of Oregon, or they have to work for an insurance company. It's the only two ways that boilers can be inspected in the state of Oregon. What we've found is, and it has been a problem that has gone on for years and years and years, and we are looking for a way to fix it. This isn't it. Currently, the Building Code Division is over 6,000 inspections behind on their annual inspections, and we actually have another piece of legislation in to try to open that and relax the requirements for the inspections. There are not enough compliance officers to make a difference as far as compliance is concerned. And we don't feel in any of the programs. Local 290, in fact, entered into an agreement with Building Code Division that we would provide our own inspector, and actually entered into a relationship with our contractors and hired a retired state police officer just to do compliance inspections and license checks for plumbers. We thought the program was relatively successful, and frankly, we're desperate for compliance. But that's not what this is aimed at, and we don't believe that it will have that great of an impact on the compliance. There just simply isn't enough funding here, and the law doesn't allow the billing codes to go on a rampage for compliance. It really doesn't. We wish it did.
Any questions?
Yeah, I think Ms. Adkins just tried to explain. There is, at this point, no general funds now that are going to the boiler board.
That's my understanding.
So basically it will reduce general fund by 75,000 or 111,000 is what we got to 305.
Tamara okay. Brickman, you want to come forward from DCBS and help us explain the cycle of money that goes and circulates around, much like a boiler would?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tamara Brickman. I am the legislative coordinator, for lack of a different title, for the Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And it is my understanding that the Building Codes Division receives its funding for the different program areas from either the license fees that are assessed against, or that are charged for people to become licensed in the different areas, or for fines. So it is my understanding that we do not receive any general funds to run any of the programs within the Building Codes Division.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Well, follow up. Yeah. At this point in time, though, the money was going into the general fund.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, correct. The money now for this, the penalties that are issued under the Board of Boiler Rules go into the general fund. We have penalties that are issued through different boards that all go back to the program area in which they are received. This is the only this is the only fund or penalty through a board that goes directly to the general fund instead of back to the department.
Well, I guess follow up then. What my question was is then, it appears then that the boiler board will actually have an extra $100,000 or $75,000 or how much ever you are going to be raising in a year.
And
the follow up, I just want to know then, with that extra money, what will you be using it for?
Senator Metzger, Senator Anderson, Mona Sanderson, I believe you are correct that the fiscal on this would result in the money coming to the Board of Boiler Rules, which is about $100,000 a biennium, and it would go for enforcement purposes with the Board of Boiler Rules. Thank you.
Okay. Might comment on that. Just one clarification. It would be an amount probably, I would guess, slightly less than that, unless there's a because the law would not take effect to January 1st, 2008. So it would be about one quarter less than that.
Okay. You can step aside for a moment. Catherine Van Etta, if you want to come forward. Hello.
Hello. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. The Pulp and Paper Association members, the pulp and our paper mills located in Oregon, do have boilers. We use boilers to make the steam that powers our facilities and hog fuel boilers, and we do have lots of high-pressure piping, and we are regulated by the boiler board. Now, no one has talked to us about this bill or the need or the problems with compliance. First, the committee should recognize that. Second, we have the issue of why, and I think I've heard a little bit of the background of from one person's perspective about why this should be changed. But as a matter of policy, the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association does not support fine money from enforcement going back to the agency that levies the fines. It's never been our practice to support that public policy in Oregon nor in Washington, where we also operate as a regional trade association. So we would oppose this change, and if you were to pass this bill, we would want to hear from the department, because there's been information put on the record that there seems to be a problem that needs to be corrected. I'd like to hear from the department about whether there are problems or not enough funding for doing enforcement.
Okay. I guess my first question back to you would be the testimony we received from DCBS that this is the only board that doesn't receive it this way. So I guess I would ask you the opposite question is, why should they be different than all the other boards who have those funds go back into management of their duties?
Chair Metzger, as a matter of public policy, I can't speak to why the legislature arranged it that way in the past for the different boards. I would imagine that it was a matter of funding in the past, but I would also say that the boiler board is a little bit fundamentally different than some of the other boards because of what they do inspect and regulate, and the size of, say, the industrial boilers in different manufacturing plants or refrigeration type systems, and that it's just perhaps the decision was made in the past that it was fundamentally different.
Okay. So just a follow-up question. So is your fear the fact that since they are administering the civil penalties, that in order to, that maybe there would be more civil penalties issued because that's how they're supporting themselves?
Chair Metzger, Senator Mons Anderson, it's not a fear so much as a position that we've taken on this issue when it's arisen before, as far as penalties going back into the agency that is assessing the penalties. It's a matter of our policy. It's not so much the fear factor being involved. We believe that the board and their inspectors do a fine job of what they're supposed to do. It's a matter of just in practicality. This happens only on a very limited basis with the Department of Environmental Quality, which is our major regulatory agency that regulates our environmental compliance in the state.
Okay. Either Senator Devlin or Ron, can either of you, and maybe you can't, but provide any insight into the particular motivation then for the bill, so we can, if there is one, we can have it on the record, and as opposed to, gee, we're the only one that doesn't. I mean, is there some underlying reason that has prompted this?
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, there really isn't. As I spoke to before, the Board of Boiler Rules is responsible for the inspections of boilers and pressure vessel piping. And currently, there are over 6,000 inspections behind with no plan to catch up, no plan to improve it. And we have these boilers, as you've heard, they're large industrial boilers that are placed within your community, as well as every single school has one. And there simply isn't any way for the Board of Boiler Rules to ensure compliance without compliance inspectors. As a matter of policy, I don't think I would bring before the legislature a change just because we need to be consistent with the other boards. But if there is a fear that there'll be a run on the bank, so to speak, and with the fees remaining within the boiler board, one need only look at the plumbing program and the electrical program to see that that's not the case, that there are relatively few compliance cases that come before the boards, and the Building Codes Division does a very, very thorough job in ensuring that the cases that come before the boards are good, sound cases and in fact, rely on case laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I appreciate that, and this committee previously did hear a move, a bill regarding the boiler board and some issues regarding that in terms of inspection and insurance. I guess my the only concern I have at the moment is that we don't have anybody here from the boiler board, or at least they have not signed up, to discuss their backlog and how this may impact trying to perform their duty a little better. So I think what I'm going to do is we're going to ask to have someone from the board come and explain, you know, how they would use these resources to meet their mission, you know, and maybe erode the backlog. I think the committee would like to hear that.
Very fine.
So that we can answer those questions affirmatively to all of our colleagues, if that's okay.
Very fine. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Let's close public hearing on Senate Bill 24 for the moment. And we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 603. Janet.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 603 would reduce the required proportion of directors of a domestic insurer that must be residents of Oregon from one-third to one-quarter, and it does take effect on passage by declaring an emergency. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think there's just two people signed up.
We're about to find out who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like they're standing over here.
Okay, John Powell and Justin Delaney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing Standard Insurance. With me today is Justin Delaney, Vice President of Corporate Legal and Public Affairs. He's also Assistant General Counsel at Standard. He'll present the bill.
Okay. Welcome.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Justin Delaney. I'm here today from Standard Insurance Company to ask for your support of Senate Bill 603. This is a section of the Oregon statute that very few people ever look at or think about. It's one that's become very important to us in recent years. Standard last year celebrated our 100-year anniversary as an Oregon company. And in those 100 years, we've had a lot of success. We've now grown to provide insurance, retirement plans, investment advice to over 8 million customers nationwide. And we now employ 3,300 people, most of whom are here in Oregon. At the same time, we've sought to increase the knowledge base and expertise of our board of directors. We're not as big as some of our competitors. You know their names, but we're a fraction of the size of insurance companies who compete against us in the national market. So we do compete on customer service and specialized expertise. In recruiting directors for our corporation, we look for chief executive level talent in a couple of key areas. In the last few years, we've been looking for financial services experience or experience in finance and marketing. We also have a commitment to ourselves to look for diversity. We look for diversity in belief, in ethnicity, and in knowledge. These are not attributes that are plentiful in Oregon, unfortunately, and we've had a hard time recruiting directors, also partially thanks to our friends Sarbanes and Oxley. Not a lot of people want to be on board of directors anymore. As we compete on this national level now, we're competing against bigger companies who can pay their directors more as well. So it's gotten harder. This section of the Oregon statute places what we believe to be an artificial limit on us in placing a minimum number of directors who must be Oregon residents. Other companies in Oregon don't have this limitation. The Nikes of the world don't have to deal with this kind of limitation. We're not asking to remove the Oregon residency requirement, but to drop it down to 25%. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I guess I have one question. How many domestic insurers in Oregon now are there?
Not a whole lot, Chair Metzger. I couldn't give you the exact number, but I know of only a handful.
John,
Mr. Right? Chairman, again, John Powell. I'm not sure how many. It's a handful at the most. The mergers and acquisitions over the years have swallowed up most of the domestics, so there are very, very few.
Yeah. I think there were too many. Well, I'll have Star ask this question first.
A handful. I mean, can you name, give me an example, and the other question is if, I mean, obviously you've asked for this bill, or this bill would impact them as well. Is there anyone else that's, obviously no one else is here to sign up to testify in the bill, but...
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, to your first question, besides Standard, there'd be Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. Sublimity Insurance Company used to be, but they are now, I believe, owned by a parent from out of state. They may still technically possibly qualify as a domestic. Beyond that,
pretty short list, Mr.
Chair. North Pacific Insurance Company, which I used to represent, is now owned by Liberty Mutual, so Liberty Northwest. So it there are fewer and fewer.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Oregon Mutual is the only one I could think of, so you came up with another one. Well, my own thing on this is when you're a private corporation, you're not dealing with the public, and it doesn't mean that the board can't have a third or can't say under your rules, you know, that you could have all five from Oregon. So I think that would certainly be the discretion of the company to decide what the flexibility would want. I would have no problem with that. I don't understand what the... I could see 100 years ago when Standard started and everybody was pretty well doing a domestic market, there might be some concern about outsiders, but I think we're well past that, and I think the corporation can figure out what its membership should be. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What if someone wants to merge with you and make it multi-state? Then you are no longer a domestic insurer?
That's right, Chair Metzger, Senator Montes Anderson. This is an Oregon rule. If we were based anywhere else, this would not apply. And as you know, we're in Portland, across the river from us. This rule doesn't apply.
But nothing would preclude that if, for some reason, Standard wanted to merge with another insurer, that couldn't happen.
That's correct. There are review requirements by DCBS, but there are no prohibitions against mergers and acquisitions in the insurance industry.
Is there a problem now with maybe having too many outsiders on the board?
No, it's actually what we're looking for is this specialized type of experience that we're having trouble finding, and when you combine that search to the state of Oregon, it gets that much harder. Another issue that we've encountered, the retirement age on our board of directors is 72, so a lot of our directors, once they gain experience on the board, they retire from their full-time occupation. A number of them have been lifelong Oregon residents and chose to retire elsewhere, whether it be the Palm Desert or just across the river in Vancouver. And the fact that they spent their life and career in Oregon no longer benefits us. We're penalized under the statute.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it's too dissimilar to the bill colleagues we had a couple of weeks ago on the co-ops, in which it is getting increasingly difficult to find people who want to take on the responsibility to even be on a board, much less trying to find the expertise that you need to service the, in this case, the shareholders of the company. Any other questions? Okay. No one else has set to testify on it, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 603 and open a work session on Senate Bill 603.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 603 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 603 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Please mark Senator George and Senator Deckard as excused. And I guess I'll carry the bill. I'll start off the parade today. All right, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 748. Janet. Accountancy again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 748, and you should have the newly minted Dash 2 amendments. The bill was brought to you by the Oregon Society of CPAs, and the original bill would have deleted a requirement that public accountants that are licensed in good standing in another state be authorized, have to be authorized or to pay an annual fee to the Board of Accountancy in order to practice in Oregon. The Dash 2 amendments narrow that exemption, if you will, and replace the bill. They allow an active CPA or public accounting firm that's licensed and based in another state to prepare, advise, or assist in the preparation of personal income tax returns for Oregon residents, and that would be without having to be authorized by the Board of Accountancy. Mr. Chair, Board would still, as you'll hear in the testimony, would still have the ability, if something is miscarried out by the tax preparer, would have the ability to sanction the out-of-state tax preparer. Thank you.
Mr. McConnell and Mr. Bailey, if you want to come forward. We'll start with you, Mr. McConnell, since your society had this bill.
Thank you, Senator Metzger, committee chairs or committee members. We appreciate the chance to talk.
Please just mention your name for the record.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Stephen McConnell. I'm an Oregon CPA, a member of the Legislative Policy Committee of the Oregon Society of CPAs, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about Senate Bill 748. Essentially, as the committee administrator, Ms. Atkins, indicated, the purpose of this bill is to make it easier for individuals to prepare tax returns, CPAs to prepare tax returns, even if they're licensed in other states. In a sense, this is like a driver's license issue. Other states, you get a driver's license and you're still allowed to drive in the state of Oregon. However, with respect to CPAs, CPAs are licensed separately in each state. We all pass a common examination, but the licensure procedures vary from state to state. And the licensing process between states tends to become somewhat cumbersome. So there is a movement going on to try to ease the ability of CPAs to practice between states. And in the course of discussions with the Board of Accountancy, we have taken a first step toward trying to ease that practice by dealing with people who are practicing in out-of-state CPAs who are deemed to be practicing in the state by preparing tax returns for residents of the state of Oregon. So the bill that we're talking about would clarify the tax practitioner statute to exempt any CPA, and currently the only parties who are exempted are Oregon-licensed CPAs, so we would broaden that exemption from their statute. We would also provide that a tax preparer from another state would not be deemed to be holding out and therefore subject to the accountancy board rules when preparing an Oregon tax return without an Oregon license, as long as the tax preparer has no office in the state of Oregon. And the practitioner's firm name could also be used without being deemed to be subject to be holding out in the state of Oregon. We think that this is a practical way of dealing with an issue which has become increasingly confusing over the last several years as there's an increasing interstate practice, particularly in the tax arena. And we've talked to the board about that, and the board we and the board have cooperated in coming up with language which you have in front of you. Thank you very much.
Before we go to questions, let's hear from Mr. Bailey.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Metzger and committee members. For the record, my name is Kent Bailey. I'm an Oregon CPA and vice chair of the Board of Accountancy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on the Dash 2 amendment of Senate Bill 748. The Board of Accountancy and the Oregon Society of CPAs are in agreement on this amendment, and both the Department of Revenue and the Board of Examiners, tax examiners, have advised the board they have no objections to the amendment. The Dash 2 amendment addresses an important mobility concern, that is tax preparation by certified public accountants who are licensed in other states who do not have an office in the state of Oregon. Currently, Oregon revised statutes require certified public accountants in other states who file returns with the Oregon Department of Revenue to be licensed in the state of Oregon. The Dash 2 amendment recognized the professional skills held by certified public accountants licensed in other states by removing the requirement to have an Oregon license. The amendment maintains public protection and received a unanimous vote of approval by the board on March 23rd. We appreciate the OSCPA's understanding of the board's concerns related to public protection, and the board and the OSCPA have successfully used task forces in the past to resolve issues, and the board is confident that the collaboration on broader issues of mobility will result in a solution that provides for mobility while maintaining public protection. The board looks forward to working with the professional organization on this important issue. The Board of Accountancy joins the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants in requesting the committee's support of the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 748. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. A question that either one of you might want to address this. This committee previously passed out House Bill 2079, which dealt also with reciprocity issues, primarily with public accountants. I was just wondering how this dovetails with that in terms of, because I think the questions did circle around flexibility and allow folks from outside the state to do different accounting practices. Can you give me any insight as to how this dovetails with that bill at all?
I'd have to, Senator Metzger, I'd have to look at that particular bill to be sure, but my understanding was that was relatively a housekeeping bill. This is a somewhat broader bill from the standpoint of making it clear that anyone coming in from out of state has the ability to do tax practice without a formal registration in front of the board. This is effectively a no registration bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, Carol says she can answer.
Excuse me? Okay. Carol, why don't you go ahead and answer that question? Because I don't know if anybody else in the committee, but I'm just kind of curious because we're kind of dealing with some similar issues, but I know we're talking about different kind of accounting in some respects, but we're definitely talking about flexibility to get people to practice. So,
thank
welcome.
You, Mr. Chair. My name is Carol Rees. I'm the administrator for the Board of Accountancy, and I'm a familiar face from House Bill 2079. These two bills dovetail, but they are somewhat different. 2079 was an effort by the board to remove a reference to the Uniform Accountancy Act from our statute. Because the Uniform Accountancy Act is a model act and is under constant change, the board was fearful of having our requirements for a license authority called substantial equivalency be tied to a model act that is under change without having the opportunity to review and consider those changes prior to it becoming effective in Oregon. And so housekeeping it was in that we were changing the words Uniform Act to Oregon's, the broad breadth of Oregon statutes. The difference between this is that under substantial equivalency, this is a provision that allows licensees from other states to practice in Oregon on in an expedited manner. They simply provide us with a notice that they're going to be practicing and a fee of $100. We turn around a permit to them within 24 hours, and then they may practice in our state without going through the normal licensing routine. What this bill does is removes that requirement for licensed CPAs in other states who are going to be preparing tax returns in Oregon. And this is significant because Oregon is one of the few states that has a licensing requirement for preparation of tax returns, specifically personal income tax returns. And that requirement is regulated by the Board of Tax Practitioners. Under that requirement, there is an exemption for licensed CPAs, but the exemption right now only applies to Oregon licensed CPAs. So that means that someone from Idaho who's preparing a tax return for in Oregon that will be filed in Oregon must come through the board under substantial equivalency and at least receive that authority to prepare the tax return. By removing the language that limits the exemption to Oregon CPAs, it means that any licensed CPA in any jurisdiction may prepare tax returns that will be filed in Oregon without a license. And this is a common practice among other states. That is, other states don't have a separate licensing requirement as we do here. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's clear as mud.
Yeah. No, actually, it is very clear because, and I thought that was important because I think, as you recall, I think some of the concern over the previous bill was that there was some concern at that point, and I know there's been conversations since that which kind of cleared that up, but I just think for the record was thinking that we were making it more difficult for qualified people to come and practice in Oregon. This seems just the opposite, you know, that we're trying to allow those flexibilities, and I just kind of wanted to get that out. So I appreciate that. Questions? Any questions? Senator Mona Sanderson.
I'm not sure who it should go to, but I don't know a lot about the qualifications of a CPA, but I'm sure it's quite different than a nurse. But when I got my nurse outside the state, yet I needed to have a license here in Oregon, but I wasn't required to take the test over. The state accepted my training that I had in the state of Virginia. This would allow someone who was trained somewhere else to file tax returns for someone within the state without having to register it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, that is correct.
And are there disadvantages to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, the disadvantage to the Board of Accountancy would be the reduction of revenue that we currently receive from these people from out of state who are now coming through under substantial equivalency at $100 a year annual fee. And I believe on the back side of the testimony that Mr. Bailey provided you, there's a little fiscal impact. For example, in 05-07, we've licensed approximately 261 out-of-state licensees under substantial equivalency. I don't remember the percentages now, but we've determined what percentage of those come here only for the purpose of tax returns. And then we've extrapolated that increase for 07, 09, and 09, 11. I don't have it in front of me, but I think the fiscal impact in 07, 09 is $27,000 loss. And extrapolating again to 09, 11 is $34,000. This is not a huge amount of money, except that one must consider we are a small board with a small budget, and so every amount, you know, is going to affect our operations to some extent. But that is the only impact. The only downside to what we see is that the board itself will have a reduction of fees, of revenue.
And those that prepare outside the state, are they primarily with corporations or individual or?
Senator Metzger? Senator Moniz Anderson? Mr. McConnell wants to respond to that question.
Senator Metzger, Senator Moniz Anderson, I think it is a very broad range of types of returns that are being prepared by people out of state. I don't have statistics, they may be being prepared for corporations. They may be being prepared for individuals, probably more likely more individuals than corporations because there are more individuals than corporations. And in terms of who is preparing them, they may be prepared by individual CPAs, which are in large firms, small firms, or sole practitioners. It's across the board. Mm-hmm. I hope that's responsive.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. We'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 748, open work session on Senate Bill 748.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the dash two, sir.
Yes.
Move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 748.
Senator Starr has moved the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 748. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Chair, I move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 748 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
A comment. On page 7, it lists, where did you find that? I can't find that. Line 16. Why don't we match up? Well, let me look at Ms. Atkins. It basically says that it's really only directed toward personal income tax returns. Is that correct? Notwithstanding a person. So the dash ones are different from dash twos, and this will be anyone, because the dash ones was just personal income, and the dash twos is for anyone, like we said.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Any other questions?
And that didn't upset the numbers for the board. Okay. All right.
Senator Deckert, we've just moved the dash two amendment on Senate Bill 748 on the Board of Accountancy. Do you feel comfortable in voting on the bill, or would you like to wait?
Is this the same? This seems very similar to the bill that we passed out 3-2.
It's different. We have that discussion. But if you would like,
I'm fine. Is everyone?
We're fine.
Great. Go.
All right. Any objection to the motion for Senate Bill 748 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation? Objection. So ordered. Public Works Senator Larry George is excused. And Senator Monis Anderson, because you're becoming Miss Accountant, I'll ask you if you'd be kind enough to carry the bill. Okay. Moving along here. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 545. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 545, and at this point you should have the dash 3 amendments. And John Brenneman has hand engrossed the dash 3 amendments, and that should be at your place too to make it clear what the amendments do. The amendments this is the bill that would funeral service practitioners and apprentices and embalmer apprentices.
Mm-hmm.
It would delete one of the provisions of the original bill that would have authorized apprentice practitioners to perform duties upon the first taking custody of a body. But the amendment still delete the reciprocity restriction on the type of licensing in other states. The amendment deletes a requirement that apprenticeships occur within a certain number of years prior to the exam date, allows the service of an apprentice for an aggregate instead of a consecutive 48 months, and makes languages parallel for the embalmer and practitioner apprentices. And one final thing the amendments do is specify that a licensed practitioner and embalmer may have no more than 3 interns at a time. This bill was at the request of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, and the hearing was held on March 26th.
Do we have anybody here from the association who would like to just kind of comment and refresh the committee's memory on the amendment? We were talking about the difficulty of getting people in the profession, and
good afternoon.
Welcome
Thank
again.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Wally Ordeman. I'm a funeral director in Albany and a board member of the Oregon Funeral Directors Association and a past president. After our hearing last week, I was able to sit down with Mr. Coe, the executive director of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and in our discussions, really streamlined this bill. And if you'd like, I'd just hit some of the highlights.
Please.
That'd be all right. There are 5 main points to this bill. One being that this extends a courtesy to our own licensees here in Oregon that is currently being offered to out-of-state licensees, and that's those that have been grandfathered in licensing prior to the associate degree requirement for them to be able to, if they've retired, for instance, or stepped away from the business or moved out of state, allows them to come back in, allows an Oregon licensee to bypass the requirement for an associate degree if they have 4 years' experience. It just adds in this state. Right now, the statute reads in another state. So we're looking to extend that same courtesy to our own licensees. The second point would be that we are this bill would delete the time frames between the apprenticeship and education and or testing. Currently, the statute provides a very narrow window for that to happen, either the apprenticeship and then the testing, giving very little opportunity for somebody to, say, pursue a bachelor's degree. Because right now, the way the statute reads, you have a two-year time frame to get your testing, do your testing when the apprenticeship is done. I mentioned earlier the three interns per preceptor. Mount Hood Community College has a requirement that the mortuary students serve an internship. In the metro area that's served by Mount Hood Community College, sometimes very difficult to find funeral director embalmers that can be preceptors for on a one-to-one ratio. This would allow licensees to be a preceptor for up to three Mount Hood Community College students. The fourth point changes the 48 months consecutive time frame for apprentices to an aggregate time, which means you could apprentice for a set period of time, walk away for educational purposes or whatever the case may be, and return to an apprenticeship without that clock ticking. The fifth would be the reciprocation issue. This part of this that does a couple of different things. Lifts the restriction. Right now, somebody that wants to come to this state and practice as a funeral director or embalmer must immediately go from that state to this state. It doesn't give any window for somebody who is either hasn't found a job yet, or somebody that, say, takes 2 or 3 months to make that move, likely doesn't qualify for reciprocation because of that word immediately. The other part of this is that the term substantially equal would be removed from the language. Main difference with the substantially equal is that some states require apprenticeships, some do not, and that's been the big sticking point with the substantially equal provision of this statute. The with apprenticeships, we feel that with regard to apprenticeships, we feel that someone licensed in good standing in another state for 3 out of the past 5 years has certainly qualified, done everything that an apprentice would do, and we feel that the licensing authority of other states should be recognized in that way.
Thank you very much. That was put that in very orderly fashion. We all were making our notes, I see, on that. Questions? Concerns?
If I may, Senator Metzger, yes. Members of the committee, I also would like to add this has zero fiscal impact, as well as over the course of last week, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board did have their regularly scheduled meeting and unanimously voted to support this bill.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll in a work session now on...
Move the desk, three members of Senate Bill 545.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 545. Any discussion? Any objection? Sure.
Move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 545 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Dickert, I just think the way you carry bills, that this would be a perfect one for you to carry.
You weren't paying attention to my last.
I was.
I was.
You were excused on the bill you carried today, I remember, so I thought you did an excellent job, so we'll ask you to carry the bill.
Okay. And Senator George is excused.
And Senator George is excused. Okay, let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 746. Janet, we're on the same topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 746 is Senator Byers' bill, and I think he's planning to be down here. He's in Judiciary Committee, so we may have to locate him.
Maybe could you check Judiciary Committee?
The original bill would have exempted nonprofit and religious cemeteries and those with 25 or fewer burials a year from reporting and inspection requirements, and from initial and biennial fees for state operating authority from the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. You have before you the Dash 1 amendments. It applies the exemption to cemeteries with 25 or fewer burials per year that are also either religious or nonprofit. The or was supposed to be an and. So this is a smaller number of cemeteries than the original bill would have affected. The Dash 1 amendment, you do have a fiscal impact statement for it because it does have an effect on the fees that the mortuary and cemetery board collect.
Okay. Well, we're waiting for Senator Barwell. Is Joel Daniels here? Come forward. State your name, and if you sign up in support of the bill, you can give us a little background.
Yes, Joel Daniels. I live in Clackamas County. I'm a member of Smyrna United Church of Christ, and we operate a cemetery. And I wanted to come and speak in support of this bill today, that I feel there's an undue burden on small cemeteries, nonprofit cemeteries, to go through the licensing process. We've gone through it with our church, and we are successfully licensed. And as long as we can keep people from dying and have less than five per year, we will not have to continue to pay fees. However, every time we change the officers of the committee that operates the cemetery, we have to pay for an FBI background check, which is another financial burden. And we are solely reliant on donations from families to keep the cemetery maintained. And so any money that we would have to pay for licensing is difficult for us. I'm also involved with another very small cemetery, and I don't think people realize how many there are in the state, that until recently has had no organization at all. It's a historic cemetery. It goes back to 1857, and it would come under the historic exemption, except that once in a while, perhaps every 3 to 5 years, someone gets buried there. Someone just comes and picks out a place where there doesn't appear to be anyone buried, and they're buried there. So I've been working with a group trying to get that cemetery organized. It's very small, probably 30 graves. And we have managed with some donated legal expertise to get it qualified as a nonprofit cemetery. Ownership is questionable. It probably belongs to Clackamas County, but that's what it says on the map. But Clackamas County is not interested in doing any maintaining of it. So since I have relatives buried there, I'm interested in working with it and having it better maintained. It would be a real burden to get people to serve and to get this to happen if we had to go through an elaborate licensing procedure. There aren't any records. There's nothing to start with. And yet I feel like just the act of trying to get this organized makes us out of compliance with state law. So I feel like proposals in this bill would address those kinds of situations and would be very helpful for these very small cemeteries.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Mosher.
If we did away with the licensing, would you still have to register?
Well, as I understand it, you still register, but you wouldn't have to pay any fees or...
Okay.
I'm not sure about the background checks. It just seems so foreign to us in the church to suddenly have to do background checks when we're just asking for volunteers to serve on a committee to help manage the cemetery part of the church.
A follow-up? Mm-hmm. I think the goal was because we're running into problems with cemeteries, I guess, with vandalism and... doing things to the graves, but I am I really feel that every cemetery or wherever a human is buried, we would need to know where that is. So I would
want
the registration. And I'm surprised there isn't a difference, or maybe there is a difference in fee for those that are very, very small. Yeah. And I was just wondering how much you're talking about in...
Well, I think the fee was something like $150.
Okay, a year.
Which is a lot if you have nothing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Beyer has arrived. Senator, we're talking about Senate Bill 746.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9, and I'm senior stalling for time as my bill file gets here, as I was in another committee, and I was busy on another bill up there and didn't get back to my office. The bill, and you've already, I assume, heard from Mr. Daniels, a constituent of mine who brought the issues, one of the constituents of mine who brought the issues forward that prompted this bill, and if my bill file gets here, I have notes in it as to what the bill does. But if you have any questions,
I'll tell you what we'll do then, Senator. While we're in for that, we have someone from the Mortuary and Cemetery Board who signed up in opposition. Maybe we'll get those issues on the table. So, David, if you want to come forward, and that'll give us a good grist for the mill here to discuss this bill. Okay. Janet has a comment first.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to enter for the record an email from Ty Cochran from the Cemetery Association of Oregon in opposition to Senate Bill 746, and there are some reasons listed in the email.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is David Coe. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. The board had a regular meeting last week, March 27th, and voted to oppose this bill. The provisions of the board's current regulations already make accommodation for small cemeteries to some extent. And by small cemeteries, I'm thinking of those that have a relatively low level of activity. Currently, if a cemetery performs 5 or fewer interments per year, or 10 or fewer per biennium, our license renewal cycle works on a biennial basis. Those cemeteries are not required to pay a renewal fee. So the line is currently drawn at cemeteries that perform 10 or fewer in a biennium. We have also made some other accommodations. Most recently, we had a license fee increase not long ago, and we increased the initial application fee for a facility license from $100 to $150. But where the small cemeteries were concerned, those that perform 10 or fewer in a biennium, we kept that license, that initial application fee at $100 and did not raise that to $150. That initial $100 also includes the first principal. We have principal fees and change of principal fees. They are principals are those that have a controlling interest. They control money. They somehow manage the cemetery. So for a small cemetery, the initial application fee would be $100, but that would include the $50 for the first principal. And then upon if there was more than one principal, the cemetery would pay $50 for each initial or each additional principal. Sometimes those change of principal fees are mistaken for background check fees. And it's really a change of principal fee or a principal fee, not a background check fee, although we do have authority to perform criminal background checks on the principals of licensed facilities. They're not FBI checks. We don't have authority to access the National Criminal Information System. These would be State of Oregon Law Enforcement Data System checks. After establishing the...
Mr. Chair, I'm totally confused on this discrepancy between background checks and principal, whatever you called it.
Chair Metzger, Senator Montes Anderson, I was referring back to, I don't have his last name, the gentleman's comment with regard to FBI background checks as being an expense. And I wanted to make two points there. One is there is no fee for a background check. and there is we don't conduct FBI background checks. The fee is for the for each principal and for each change of principal.
But what's now, a principal? I'm sorry.
A principal is a person who has control over the cemetery,
either
of its business operations or issues checks or has to do with the financial operations of the cemetery. Those who have principal control over the cemetery. So those are two things that we've done in order to reduce the burden on cemeteries with a low level of activity. It came to our attention later that even though we were disabusing small cemeteries of the requirement to pay a renewal fee once every 2 years, and by the way, the renewal fee is $4 per interment currently, so that if you had 10 interments, the fee without the exemption would be $40. We found that with some small cemeteries, they had an awful lot of elderly volunteers, and there was frequent turnover, and we were, in one sense, making an exemption to try and relieve them of this burden as far as the renewal fee, but if they had three board members who changed or three principals who changed during the course of that two-year period, they would be subject to $150, three change of principal fees of $50 each. And it didn't seem to be an equitable situation given that they had already been exempted from paying the renewal fee. So the law was changed a couple of sessions ago, and currently these cemeteries that perform 10 or fewer interments per biennium not only do not pay a renewal fee, but they don't pay a fee for any change of principal if they're at that 10 or fewer per biennium, except for the change of managers. Manager, the little cemeteries, the ones that we spoke with, wanted us to retain that provision for the change of principal for the manager, and then we would conduct a background check on that person just to ensure that that was a reputable person who had the most critical control over the cemetery. There were a couple of things in the bill that I thought were worth mentioning. One was that there are aspects of the bill that have, I think they relieve the small cemeteries of reporting requirements, and I wanted you to know that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board has no reporting requirements. So I don't know what we would be relieving them from. Currently, we don't have any reporting requirements. And there's another provision in the bill that would compel small cemeteries to provide the board with an annual financial statement. In dealing with these small cemeteries, many of them would not, I don't think, understand really what a financial statement was and how to put one together. If it's a financial statement in the commonly used, as the term is commonly used, they might have to get outside expertise to help them put together a financial statement, which could, in the end, cost them more than what it would to pay these small fees. If the financial statement was required, I wouldn't have anything to do with it. I'd put it in a box, and when the box filled up, I'd get another box. But the board doesn't have any current need for financial statements. Under this bill, the board would also retain its responsibilities for licensing and inspection and investigating complaints. As I read it, the inspections would be unannounced. I mean, could not be unannounced. Currently, we conduct random inspections of funeral homes and crematories, and they're unannounced. Under this bill, we would still be conducting inspections. They just wouldn't be unannounced. That really hasn't been too much of a problem in my experience, at least, because most small cemeteries don't have an office. There isn't any place really for an inspector to pop in, and very often if the records are kept at home, we don't make unannounced inspections at someone's residence. We wouldn't come and knock on your door. If it's the kind of a cemetery where the records are kept at someone's home, we would typically call and make an appointment if we can to try and inspect those records. I think what you have before you from LFO is a fiscal analyst of proposed fiscal analysis of proposed legislation. The apparent loss of revenue under this bill is relatively small. It appears as though in the 07-09 biennium, the board would lose only about $12,413 in revenue. But if you look at the backside of the of this fiscal analysis, I think there's a fairly concise explanation as to how that small amount of money might have a significant effect, given the fact that the board is already confronting a significant revenue shortfall. We're already in a position where we may lose one of only six positions, and we have a very small cash balance even after one position is eliminated. The LFO recommends that for boards our size, we should have a 4 to 6 month cash balance. In the past, I've been told it was 3 to 6, but this analysis indicates 4 months. As it stands, if we eliminate a position and don't obtain a fee increase, and then that's a very dicey issue as to whether or not the board, the legislature, will approve a fee increase in another area in our ways and means bill. But if the budget goes through as it stands right now, the board would have a 1.9-month cash balance, significantly less than the 4 months that's recommended. And I think LFO, based on the way our revenue comes in and the way we've been able to save money and those sorts of things, has been willing to consider that 1.9-month cash balance. But I suspect that if we lost just that $12,500 and that pushed us down to 1.66, that's going to cause LFO to reconsider its recommendation, and perhaps instead of losing simply one position, we might have our two investigators be reduced from full-time to three-quarters time, which has ramifications for turnover and recruitment and those sorts of things.
Okay. Mr. Quarch, I think I'm going to go on now to Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. Appreciate your patience as I got my paperwork here. As we just heard from Mr. Koch, the bill obviously needs some amendments. We have one amendment drafted, and it's a -1, I believe, dealing making the bill to the intent of the bill, which as on page 1, lines 13 through 20, we need to have an and down there so that the intent was only cemeteries that have 25 or fewer interments annually, and is one of the other two, A or B, not or. So it would not include all tax-exempt cemeteries. That was not the intent of the bill. That is how we get the bill limited. This bill is brought forward, I'm assuming Mr. Daniels testified prior to me coming in, by some issues that were brought forward to me by small cemeteries in my district where they were being subject to random inspections and fees that sounded like they were completely inappropriate to me and my discussions with the constituents. So I had this bill drafted. Obviously, after listening to the testimony, we would also want to remove line 33 of the bill, the annual financial statements of the cemetery. The board would have no reason to get an annual financial statements. The small cemeteries would really have no reason to want to have them done. It would still probably be a good idea, if we were to pass this bill, to have them report on the number of annual interments, so they would, the board would know if a cemetery is at that magic number, which would be 25, or if they hit 26. I think it's a good bill, a good issue. I would ask how many complaints and issues are brought forward that this board investigates by these small operating cemeteries. I asked that question, and Mr. Koch was not able to give me an answer there, and I don't know if he is able to get the answer to that question since then. But they're generating roughly $12,000 on a biennial basis in revenue. But what are the complaints generated by this board? And this board, should be there to investigate complaints and problems with operating cemeteries. And I would assume that there are not many complaints being generated by these small, non-profit cemeteries that have just a few burials a year. So, and then I guess if the number 25 isn't the right number, I chose that number just because I had to choose a number to put in the bill. 5 is obviously too low. If 25 is too high, what's the correct number to have in between those two numbers? I'd like to get input on that. If people think this 25 is too large, is that no longer a small cemetery. So, Mr. Chair, that's what's going on with the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions if I could. And at this point in time, we have one amendment. Well, obviously, we'll need more drafted before we move the bill forward.
Thank you, Senator. Well, actually, you did address, you were addressing just what I was thinking of, is, you know, what exactly is a small cemetery? I mean, I don't know if there's a definition in statute you have for a small cemetery, because the 25, it's, gee, 25 people a year, not, I know a lot of cemeteries have 25 people or less in them, but, you know, not adding 25 a year didn't seem, certainly not large, but didn't seem like a small cemetery. So I'm glad that you told us how you came up with the number, because a lot of us come up with numbers like that. So I do appreciate that. You know, questions for Senator Beyer or
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr.
I think one a month is a good definition. So
yeah.
12 in a year.
Yeah, the 12 here.
So let's change 25 to biennial.
Okay. Any other questions for the moment?
You said that this would only be, it's only 1.3% of the budget. It would reduce the board's projected revenue by 1.3%, but it's 14% of the ending cash balance. What is your total budget?
It would be for the 07-09 biennium, if it was enacted as it stands right now, would be $1,064,000. These figures are LFO figures, not my figures. The 13 and the 1.3, those aren't my figures.
Well, it seems like with a budget of $1.2 million.
Whatever it is,
12,000 is nothing.
De minimis. Mr. Chair, can I have a question for Mr. Koch? I'm sorry.
Oh, see. Feel free to correct us, please.
Yes, Mr. Koch. I understand the, I mean, you regulate a full range of cemetery and mortuary operations. And it's really an important piece of work that you do for all of Oregon. And I understand the need and the rationale to do the background checks, especially when you're dealing with pre-need, pre-sale kinds of things, where you're holding, where a cemetery mortuary is holding in trust a certain amount of money to cover future expenses. That makes a whole heck of a lot of sense to protect that financial arrangement. I mean, somebody comes in, you know, does this, you know, and it's thousands of dollars for the most part, you know, can be really a lot of money. So I understand, I think that's an appropriate opportunity place for your regulation and oversight of these activities. And we've had, unfortunately, some horror stories in the recent past. But as it relates to a cemetery that doesn't have a mortuary, it doesn't have the facilities to prepare the bodies and all that, funeral home, I think we're talking about mostly these small cemeteries that are associated with churches. They're all over my district in Washington County. Is it really necessary when we're not dealing with millions of dollars that these folks who are basically volunteers have to go through this, what seems to be relatively expensive process of the background checks? And even if it's not an FBI check, it is. You did say it's a LEDS check. You know, does the rationale really work there? And we're not talking about the same level of kind of financial dollars that are at stake.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, the variables when it comes to cemeteries are so broad. Large for-profit metropolitan fancy cemeteries, little tiny city, county, cemetery maintenance district cemeteries, little rural cemeteries that have gone back to nature. The board principally deals with operating cemeteries, those where there is an entity that is in the business of an operating cemetery. And that operating cemetery definition is contained in statute and represents a matter of the legislature's public policy. With respect to the background checks, in addition to the pre-need side of trusting, there's also endowment care trusting, where sometimes a little cemetery, even though it doesn't conduct an awful lot of burials any longer, maybe has a couple of $100,000 or even more in a trust fund, and there are trust fund reports, and sometimes that money does go missing. And there are other small cemeteries, for instance, in the Amsburg incident back in 84, board, which is was a tragedy that resulted in the board's current regulatory scheme. A funeral director was taking remains that he was supposed to be cremating out to a very small cemetery down near Lincoln City, and he was digging mass graves and burying scores of human remains in mass graves with his garbage, and when he was supposed to be cremating them. So there's a small cemetery. Usually things don't go wrong, and I think the board has looked at the public policy and over the years tried to make accommodations for small. When I say small, I just use the 10 or fewer. Who draws that line is, again, a matter of public policy. But we understand that they have less capacity to pay fees, and not only to pay fees, but to fulfill the requirements of the board, whether it's licensing. And I understand sometimes people are upset. I've been with my church for 40 years, and you're going to ask me to do a background check. The ledge checks nowadays are very quick and easy because we have access to the law enforcement data system on our desktop computers. Typically what it is entering a name, you get no hits and you're done. So it's not a very, unless something comes up, then it can become more labor intensive. Senator Beyer asked a question about complaints, and if I may, I'd like to provide a little information on that score, because I did have staff take a look at this to see if I couldn't answer his question. There is a low level of complaint activity with respect to these cemeteries that have a small number of burials. During the period from 1996 to date, we've only got 17 complaints, and it's only in three of those complaints that the board has initiated any form of disciplinary action. I can go into some generic information about that, but there's only been three disciplinary actions. One of the regulatory expense, however, is not merely limited to conducting investigations, however labor-intensive they may be. It is also somewhat labor-intensive to license folks. We have information that we need to obtain from them, and very often in the licensing process with small cemeteries, there's an awful lot of hand-holding that needs to be done while we explain how to get properly licensed and how to set up a record-keeping system, as Senator Montes Anderson was referring to. We do expect operating cemeteries to have detailed, accurate, and permanent records, and it's not all that complex if you know who's buried in your cemetery and you can show us where they are buried and you know who owns a plot. Those kinds of minimal requirements. Cemeteries, operating cemeteries, are also the repository of the permanent record for burial. That would be the green copy of the death certificate. But in most respects, if you have some sort of a book that tells you who owns what in terms of a grave, a map of the plots, and you were to indicate on that green copy of the death certificate in some way the location of this grave, that pretty much completes the record keeping requirement in a minimal sort of a way. I also wanted to comment with respect to Mr. Daniel's concerns about a small cemetery that may have 30 graves that may be a sacred place to a family. We have many cemeteries in Oregon, probably thousands, that are sacred to many of our citizens, and they're going back to nature, and I would certainly applaud any group and would not want to be an obstacle. I'm sure the board wouldn't want to present obstacles for people who have an interest in recovering those cemeteries and maintaining them, but there is a difference between taking one of a cemetery that has 30 burials and then platting and mapping it so that you're going to go into the business of selling 1,000 graves, and just wanting to go in and maintain, mow the grass, protect fence, do those sorts of things. Under those conditions, you wouldn't be an operating cemetery, and there wouldn't be any licensing requirement. Under those conditions, you would go to the Oregon Commission on Historic Cemeteries if you're not an operating cemetery, and you could be registered as a historic cemetery, and there's little grant programs that you get some help. There's not a whole lot of money, but I don't think the board's licensing requirements are intended to prohibit or prevent or be an obstacle to good hearted people who would like to protect these cultural heritage spots. The board is principally considered with human remains and how they are treated, a paper trail with respect to that process, and also if you're an operating cemetery and you're in the business of selling graves and selling pre-need, and where that line is currently drawn is at 10. I wonder, since Senator Starr mentioned 12 being one a month, I really do have to wonder whether or not for that difference between 10 and 12, there would be a good deal of effort that would have to go into moving that number from one to the next in terms of rulemaking and all of that sort of thing. But I could talk about this as you might have.
Well, I think what we're going to do, I think we're going to pause talking for today. I think we have an amendment anyway. I would ask that Senator Beyer, I think having some conversations with Mr. Cole and with Janet, myself, we'll see what we can work on this to come up with an amendment that is appropriate and has support, and I think it'd be a good way to go. So it was an interesting discussion.
Thank you, Chair.
You mentioned we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 746 Wednesday. We meet at 1 o'clock, and then we're going to come back at 5 o'clock and have an informational hearing on the cost congestion study statewide, and then also hear from Senator George's constituents.
Have you put an end time on that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. we are going to begin at 5 o'clock, and we'll be done, and I will say, at 6:30.
Okay.
And my intent is to do the cost and congestion study first, and then from that time until 6:30, we'll hear from Senator George's constituents as he has outlined them.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're adjourned.